Welcome to the PDX Files, the show that explores the world of the weird and the unexplained here in the Pacific Northwest and beyond. My name is Peach.
And I'm Mac.
Mac, what are we going to be talking about tonight?
I mean, really, if you, I guess it kind of depends on your age, but also on your curiosity into the unknown and true crime. This is one of the most famous examples of, I would kind of equate this one to the Alcatraz escape. If you know what I'm talking about, it's very similar to that as far as like,
oops,
continue. Yes, it's that big. Did they or didn't they like escape with their lives? So I think this one is specifically more important to us because it's in the area, right? So we're not in Northern California. We're here in the Pacific Northwest, and the DB Cooper story is one of the biggest unsolved mysteries of all time.
Yeah, especially if you're from Oregon, or at least kind of like peripherally to Oregon, I think you would know about DB Cooper. And obviously, to your point, I think a lot of people, even beyond Oregon, should know this story, right? But could be a generational thing.
Exactly. But I mean, essentially, we got a guy who got on board an airplane, again, pre-2001. That means a lot to people when you can, anybody just kind of get into that area. And, you know, kind of did a very subtle hijack action. And may or may not have escaped with $200,000, which at that time was a lot of money.
Absolutely. So we've got a video, as usual, that we're gonna play for you. On the screen, Mac, is that actually PDX?
Yeah, that's
it's
actually
gotta be, right?
That's the more modern version of PDX. Yeah, it is.
Got it.
And I remember back in the old days. Yeah, because I can see there's like that little roof over where all the cars go and taxi cabs.
Yeah,
that wasn't there back in the day when I was working at the airport back from 1996 through 1999, which was like
it's weird. It's weird to see it. Yeah, it's weird to see like a bird's eye view of it, because I don't look at PDX on except from on the ground, you know. So
right, because you're always traveling.
Should we play the video for our fine viewers?
I'm ready to
listeners?
I think we're ready to get into it. Yes.
Okay, here we go.
November 24th, 1971, Portland International Airport. A man named Dan Cooper boards Northwest Orient Airlines Flight 305 to Seattle.
The flight crew and the passengers describe him as an unremarkable guy. He's a Caucasian male. He's got on a dark suit, black tie, carrying a briefcase.
He has amazing hair and mustache.
The plane sits in the last row in 18E. He orders a bourbon and soda and dons a pair of sunglasses.
The plane takes off at 2:50 p.m.
The flight from Portland to Seattle is a milk run, flown several times a day. It's about an hour in the air. This time around, the plane's carrying 36 passengers and 6 crew members.
Everything's going to plan. Everything's on schedule. Until the man seated in the last row, Cooper, hands a note to the flight attendant, Florence Schaffner. She doesn't read it at first. She puts it in her pocket. And then Cooper says to her, "You might want to read that." The note.
I mean, yeah, I think I'd want to read that at that point. Florence Schaffner, by the way, that's an awesome name. Was it Oriental Airlines? Is that or Orient Airlines?
No, it's Northwest. Like, Northwest Airlines is an old defunct airline now that was bought off by, I think might have been bought off by Southwest Airlines.
Oh my God. That's so old school. It's so weird. It's just
old school.
It's an old school callback, but I mean, that's how you can, I don't think you can get away with this kind of stuff nowadays. You can't just like hand a message to somebody and expect that they're going to do everything, because there's like marshals on these things, right? Like, it's like, you know, federal marshals on some of these planes.
Yeah. Well, this was the 1970s. So,
I mean, I would be pretty freaked out if I was, you know, that flight attendant, which I wouldn't be, but I mean, I think there's something to be said for some bold action. The guy took bold action. He's like, "Hey man, you got to look at this letter. I got something for you." Boom.
I like that they described him as an unremarkable man.
Right, right. Yeah, and yet he did something like very, very outside of the ordinary. So, I mean,
yeah, it's about to take a turn. It's about to take a turn.
And just put yourself in, just for our viewer Edgar, just think about the mindset of what you have of doing something like that. What's next?
All right, well, click play here.
Note says, I have a bomb and I'd like you to sit next to me. Florence Schaffner understandably sort of loses it, but she does comply and follows his instructions.
Cooper opens his briefcase, revealing a makeshift bomb.
Schaffner describes the contents of the briefcase as something that looks like 8 sticks of dynamite, a battery, and a bunch of wires.
Cooper has her attention. She knows he's serious. He demands 4 parachutes and a ransom of $200,000 when the plane lands in Seattle.
Schaffner.
$200,000. This was 1970 money.
I know. I mean, so we should probably have a producer who could look this up for us. But what I'm thinking about is like, what about the 4 parachutes? Like, what is that all about? Like, why do you need 4 parachutes? Is there 4 other people on the plane that are part of this plan? That's kind of scary if you're the one getting this letter. It's like, oh my God, how many other weirdos are there on this plane? But yeah, I mean, I'm guessing 200. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I have a theory about that later when we talk about it. Or should I say now?
No.
About the 4 parachutes.
It's going to come into play. That's all people need to know.
Okay. So $200,000 in 1971 is worth $1,551,481.48 today.
Oh my God. So he's kind of like Dr. What was it from Austin Powers? It's like $1 million is what I need. Yeah. Yeah. So, I guess you got to respect that, but you know, just, and I've heard about bank robberies kind of going like this, like they like hand him a letter and like, just do what you're told. But he's like, come sit next to me while I, play out this whole plan with 4 parachutes, which I'm gonna really looking forward to that theory.
It'd be funny though, because I saw the note, you know, flashed on the screen and it was barely legible. I mean, wouldn't it be funny if like she goes, well, what does it say? What does this say? Where does this, you know?
Are you a doctor? Exactly. It's like I can't read this. So there's a lot of pressure on this gal definitely to like perform and come through, and not in that way, but like make the right decision. I mean, that's a very difficult position to be in.
All right, we'll continue here.
Schaffner relays the hijacker's commands to Captain William Scott. But since it's such a short flight, ground forces need more time to react.
So air traffic control keeps the plane circling around for 2 hours until they can gather the money and the parachutes.
Investigators write down the serial number of every bill and then bundle it up into a bank bag.
The plane finally lands in Seattle at 5:46 p.m.
Captain Scott parks the plane away from the building. Cooper sends out a different flight attendant, Tina Mucklow, and she goes out and interacts with the authorities. There, she collects the money and the parachutes and returns to the plane. She also brings printed instructions on how to use the parachutes, but Cooper tells her he does not need them.
Cooper agrees to let the passengers off the plane. 2 flight attendants, Florence Schaffner and Alice That's Hancock, lucky. Also ask to leave, yeah. And Cooper allows them to.
But the ordeal isn't over for the rest of the crew.
Cooper wants the 727 to take off again and start to head towards Mexico City. He's going to keep the 4 remaining crew members as hostages. The flight attendant, the flight engineer, the first officer, and the captain.
For this second flight, Cooper makes more demands.
Because why not? I mean, obviously he has more crazy demands. This is already feeling like it's some sort of Jason Bourne operation. It's like, This guy is really confident in his abilities. I mean, I got to give him credit for that, if nothing else.
I like the fact that, again, it's 1970, and how quickly, even in 1970, they can get that kind of money together.
Yeah.
You know,
how are they counting? How are they doing all this with the dollar? I mean, did they just have this stuff back in those days? So like,
or did they take money back available? Of a Chinese restaurant, you know, and then have them count it? I don't know. Kind of makes me wonder.
It's insane. Like how could they do this quickly? I mean, and nowadays it seems like things take forever to get done. Back in those days, you got to get shit done. They apparently did. So, I mean, right. Congrats to them.
All right, we'll keep going.
Cooper wants the pilots to fly with the wing flaps in an unusual configuration, a downward position. Now, that's how a plane normally takes off, but then they raise the flaps. You wouldn't fly long haul with the flaps down because it creates enormous drag and means it can't go very fast, something like 200 miles per hour.
Cooper also asked that they keep the landing gear down and fly below 10,000 feet. He wants them to be going super slow and super low.
The pilots tell Cooper it can't be
done.
That's
what she said.
They're afraid the plane might just fall out of the sky. But the hijacker is adamant that it will work, and they need to comply.
At 7:40 p.m., the plane takes off for Mexico City. But 20 minutes into the flight, Cooper does something completely unexpected.
He lowers the plane's rear air stair. The 727 has a set of stairs that can be lowered out of the back of the airplane. The pilot gets a warning light when this happens.
Once Cooper lowers the aft stairs around 8 p.m., he puts on his parachute, grabs his $200,000, and jumps out.
The hijacker
just
is
like
never
that.
Seen again.
Thoughts about that?
I mean, that is just like... The more I watch this video, the more I understand how badass that is. That is definitely Mission Impossible kind of stuff. That's like Tom Cruise, like going, he just did the Olympics thing with that, like stunt that kind of is like the kind of thing that Tom Cruise would do. It's amazing. And, you know, he must've known to an extent because he did a lot of research, obviously, into how do you slow down the plane? How do you get off the plane? He picked this plane specifically, I think, and to get off that plane and to try to maybe survive, but just manage like, I mean, it's insane. I would never do anything like this for any amount of money. But
yeah, I just think
people who were trying to do a stunt wouldn't do anything like this.
I mean, but to your point, I mean, he was very specific with the instructions on how the plane should fly, how low, you know, how high up in the air, rather, or actually how much closer to the ground. Obviously, I mean, if he's going to parachute out, he doesn't want to be up at 30,000 feet. So,
he's at 10,000 feet, 10, right?
10,000 feet. So that was fairly deliberate. Yeah. But, you know, knowing kind of like the wing flap and how that impacts the speed, I mean, it makes me wonder if he actually was also a pilot. Or handled an airplane in some form. You know, I mean, obviously there's research that he could do, or if he was in aviation, I mean, if he doesn't need to know instructions for how to use a parachute, there's a lot of things there that's like either he's maybe a parachuter or maybe part of the, you know, maybe trained in the military, you know, that kind of thing was kind of like what I was kind of thinking when I was watching this.
Right, because there wasn't any Google. There wasn't like the ability to research immediately. You'd have to go to a library and probably look at like a microfiche actually have been involved in some of these things back in your career at some point. So it's the specificity. It's the, you know, it's really clean what he was doing. It's like very planned. It's just not an idiot doing something like this.
No,
if it's an individual,
smart.
Right? So he obviously thought he was going to get away with it. The only thing that I guess he didn't ask for, I guess it, and I kind of feel bad for him if he did live and couldn't spend it. It's like, hey, non-sequential bills. Non-sequential bills. But I mean, nobody knew about that back then, right? So, I mean, that was one of those things. I guess he just didn't anticipate.
Well, either he didn't anticipate or the video just didn't go into that detail. Or if it wasn't a thing back then, I mean, or it may not have been a thing back then, you know? So maybe there
I don't know.
Wasn't
that
a way
seems
for.
So weird. How did they
There wasn't
it?
A way for banks or whatnot to, or police to track people via the sequential bills, you know what I mean? So,
and even in this year, was it 71, they said? 71?
1971, yeah.
So this is even before they had the whole thing that happened at the Olympics in 1972, right? So you had like all these terrorist plots and things happening that kind of changed the world a little back in those days. So I don't think people were thinking about non-sequential bills so much as like, you know, it's like, it's just like, there's, but he gave them enough time. I guess that was his mistake. Maybe they were actually able to respond in that way. But if you look at the sequence of events, it's very chill. It's not really that threatening, other than he's just like, hey, babe, you should probably come sit next to me and let's go through this together. But again, I'm kind of curious because I didn't look into it enough. The four parachute thing, I'm really looking forward to that whole thing.
All right, we'll keep playing.
Let's do it.
At 11.02 p.m., the pilot safely lands the plane in Reno. At this point, the flight crew has stayed in the cockpit, and they're not sure if Cooper's still in the plane or not. But when the FBI searches the plane, Cooper is definitely gone.
Almost immediately, lovely mustache. The story spreads like wildfire.
D.B. Cooper bailed out of a Northwest Airlines jet going 200 miles an hour at about 10,000 feet. The best guess is he jumped almost exactly over the center of Washington.
It looks like Vancouver is like 2 miles
FBI
away.
The FBI takes the lead on the case with assistance from sheriffs and state troopers in Washington, Oregon, and Nevada.
They have very little to go on. This guy has committed an incredibly well-planned crime.
Authorities need to begin somewhere. They start with his name.
They know he bought a ticket under the name Dan Cooper.
The FBI doesn't really suspect that's his real name, but criminals often choose an alias that's very close to their real name.
So they run this idea by the Portland police, and as luck would have it, they know of a petty criminal who goes by D.B. Cooper.
D.B. Cooper lives about an hour and a half from Portland in The Dalles, Oregon.
The Dalles, Oregon. Dan, nobody from The Dalles, Oregon is going to plan any kind of crime like this. Let's just be honest, okay? And nothing gets planned in The Dalles, Oregon.
First of all,
Google's there, so I'll give him credit for that.
First of all, I did see on that there's a manifest. It did say Northwest Orient. So I didn't realize that may have been the full name of Northwest Airlines before.
Well, I mean, I think it was, but I mean, and you know, thank you for giving me credit for that.
But I thought you were just being you.
No, I am being me to a certain extent. But again, if I see D.B. Cooper from The Dalles, Oregon, I'm not exactly expecting like a well-planned hijacking. I mean, maybe there could be some cattle tipping, something along those lines, but certainly not like D.B. Cooper, the man who like escaped justice and allegedly has $200,000 of our money. But I mean, I think that was The Dalles, Oregon. It's like, whenever they say Oregon in other places of the world, or at least within the U.S., it's like, how does that sound like Oregon? It's Oregon.
And Oregon. Plus, it's The Dalles, not The Dalles.
The Dalles, so, yes. It just it upsets me just for some reason.
Yeah, but it was a trigger for me as well.
I respect the video. I respect where they're going with this, because this is a badass look at what actually happened.
All right, let's continue.
All right.
And he's got a minor record, so police have him in the system.
It's a long shot, but they know they have to start somewhere. And they're hopeful they can nab him on his way home with $200,000 of stolen money.
A police officer drives to D.B. Cooper's house the night of the hijacking, planning to stake it out until Cooper comes home and catch him red-handed.
But as soon as the officer arrives, he sees Cooper's already home.
It seems unreasonable that D.B. Cooper would have committed the skyjacking, jumped out of the plane, and made it back home to his house in the Dalles that night.
Thank
the timeline
you
doesn't
for saying
fit
it right
in any way, shape, or form. So despite having a similar name and a criminal record, D.B. Cooper is quickly ruled out as the hijacker.
Which is pretty effed up, because D.B. Cooper is the guy who was the hijacker. So what do you think about that? I mean, if you're that guy, you're just like chilling in The Dalles, Oregon, and like sipping tea like Kermit the Frog, and all of a sudden you get like a SWAT team on your porch and like, oh hey, what did I do here to deserve this kind of treatment? That's interesting because it makes me almost wonder if the guy was, I mean, was he that lucky in his name, or did he do research on something like that around the area to try to like sort of like it's if he did, that's brilliant, right? To sort of put the breadcrumbs out in a certain direction, right?
I mean, if he's thought of everything else, he would have thought about that too, maybe, you know, and, you know, especially if since he's chosen a route, chose to jump out of a plane, out of the plane rather, at a particular time, knowing that, you know, that he would land, I think it was, they were saying there was Le Centre, Washington.
Right.
But, yeah. And I don't know what the distance is of Le Centre to, let's see here.
It's a long way. It's like hundreds of miles, but still
to the Dells. But you know, but like how you know, trying to make it as feasible as possible. It's an hour and 40 minute drive.
Yeah, but, I thought it was like at least 2 hours. But I mean, if you think it's like a very generic name, the guy in the drawings that we saw already earlier, it looks like a generic dude, and so you can see him being from the Dells. And if you could put and you can attach a certain name, just a little bit of a distraction. To me, that makes a lot of sense, especially if you're like looking for a name that would like attach. And I almost wonder, it was like, did this guy have some sort of CIA training? Because it's a very catchy name, right? DB Cooper. It's like, oh shit, DB Cooper. It's not like an ordinary like robbery kind of guy name. If that makes
sense. Right. Right. Yeah. All right, well, let's continue.
Meanwhile, at Reno Airport, authorities race to gather evidence on the plane.
Inside the plane, FBI agents find 66 latent fingerprints, but can't identify any of them. They also find Cooper's black clip-on tie and tie clip, some cigarette butts, and two of the four parachutes. That's it. That's all they have.
In 1971, we don't have fingerprint databases like we do today. We also don't have DNA at this time.
The tie clip and the tie are pretty unremarkable, so they're going to be hard to trace. There's nothing on the plane that immediately tells us who the hijacker is.
With little to go on, a large-scale manhunt begins.
The FBI knows that he jumped out of the plane somewhere between Seattle and Reno, and now they need to know where to look. But it's hard to determine Cooper's landing zone because they don't know exactly when and where he jumped. There are so many variables involved. What was the wind speed? When did he pull the ripcord? When and where was the plane exactly when he jumped?
It's next to impossible to establish an accurate search area, but they start with a massive section of really thick forest north of Portland.
This is a huge deal. The Air Force actually loans them an SR-71 Blackbird to help them photograph the entire flight area in hopes of developing a clue.
That to me is pretty crazy that the U.S. military allowed them the Blackbird, because the Blackbird was at the time, I remember as a kid hearing about the Blackbird, was like the top of the line shit, right? So they went after this guy big time, and they still couldn't find any evidence of where he actually ended up landing.
Right.
They think they do, but they don't really know. But that kind of technology was big time back in the old days.
It'd be interesting though. So with today's technology, would they be able to better triangulate and, you know, the potential landing zone, again, knowing what we know in terms of like the speed of the plane, where he could potentially, when he lowered, I'm assuming they know the exact time that they, I think they did say like 30 minutes into the flight or something like that. They lowered.
They knew about where Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like, would they be able to better triangulate now? It would be interesting.
I mean, MH370, that's all we got to say. It's, you know, as far as that goes, they still haven't found that plane. But I mean, just, you know, the fact that they gave it this much attention, I felt that looking at that video, it's like the Blackbird was involved. I've seen that plane was super cool. I'm kind of an aerial. I mean, I like air, like, those kind of things. It's kind of a thing that I like, but the idea that they really couldn't find anything, but they enlisted like all the best, and they still called the Dells is a little really unfortunate. But it's amazing that, you know, all this effort was put into it. All right. If you're looking at certain other crimes and things, and again, he's probably got a little bit lucky because they didn't have a DNA database. They didn't have a way of tracking fingerprints. So like, it's, you know, is it the timing perfect? But it leads, it still leads him to believe almost as like kind of an inside job. Like, this dude timed it perfectly and couldn't have known all these things unless they were in the know.
Yeah. And I think the rest of the video here really just dives into kind of like what it inspires. So I think we could probably end
we could totally skip that. But I mean, that's the most amazing information, is that it was able to be pulled off. It can never be pulled off today. That would never happen. I don't think we'll ever see it happen again.
Yeah. So, so what's your theory regarding the parachutes? Oh, geez.
I'm writing on your theory because I didn't really know about that part.
About the four parachutes?
No, I mean, I've heard about that he had a parachute. I don't remember what the four parachutes was about, to be honest
with you. Well, in the beginning, I thought that he was maybe making it seem like he had a big, he was part of a crew, that, you know, he was just the mouthpiece that, you know, the bartender, where's my mind at right now, that talked to the flight attendant. Hey, I mean, to be fair, they serve drinks on the plane. But to talk to the flight attendant that there may be more people involved. So that's possibly what the four parachutes were for. But then they talked about in the another part of the video that he purposefully kept four crew members on the plane. But then he would have asked for five parachutes, unless he was maybe giving them the impression that, okay, you four, you now go to the rear of the plane and you jump out and I'll commandeer this plane. But then that makes no sense either, because they could, you know, they could always shoot him down, you know, if they so chose, if he was someone like taking over the plane, especially if he was a former pilot or also, you know, or knows how to fly a plane. I don't know. Those are where my head went.
No, I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense as far as like trying to spread the suspicion of
throw him off, you know,
is right. Yeah. I also don't think that there's anything. I mean, I don't feel like this guy was nefarious in any way. I think he was probably just trying to like pull off some sort of prank, almost in a way, but he was really smart and he wanted to make a point. He never did make any kind of political point, right? There's nothing to that. It's more of like, this is the security that you guys have. I can penetrate this. I can make you guys look like a bunch of idiots, essentially. And that's kind of what he did. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if, and again, $200,000, $1 million. Okay. That's a lot of money back in those days, but it's still not that much money. That's not like over the top. There was no political reason for doing any of it. So I almost wonder if he just did it for fun and he's like laughing it up. Maybe he died recently, but he laughed it up to the day he died.
Well, like, it would be
because nobody got hurt. It was a victimless crime.
Well, I mean, he could have died on impact. I mean, his parachute may not have worked. I mean, you know what I mean? So
he's the only guy who could have gotten hurt.
Exactly. Who knows? Exactly. I mean, he could have gotten hurt, or he's still living it up right now, or, you know, at 83 years old, or whatnot. It would be, I don't know. I mean, but I'm also thinking, like, you know, to your point, I mean, it's $200,000, very specific, right? And yeah. Why not even in 1971 ask for $1 million+, right? But I have a feeling that because he figured out like how much $200,000 in cash would weigh, and how that kind of figures into, you know, parachute and all of that stuff. Like, you know, again, if you're looking at how meticulous he was with every move, I mean, I definitely don't imagine him going to the library back then, because again, you know, there was no internet, but I'd love to explore, you know, the possibility. I went to the library and said, is there a book on hijacking a plane? Or like made it so that it's like every single step was like a particular book. But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, if he did, there's a possibility that he died and it maybe landed in water and got washed out to the sea. And there absolutely was a perfect storm for not leaving any evidence. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, definitely. I mean, that it's not unprecedented to where that can happen. I mean, again, that's kind of why I mentioned the Alcatraz escape, is because there was very little evidence. There was some evidence, right, that they knew that they escaped, but they never found any bodies.
Right.
And so as long as there's no bodies, they find some evidence of something happening. It's easy to say, well, they must have died escaping, or D.B. Hood must have died. He fell into a tree and he got impaled, or whatever. He's saying that they could have happened at that height, 10,000 feet. If he was at 10,000 feet when he actually jumped, we don't really know that, right? So, and the speed of the plane, we don't know any of the actual details of his death or not death. So, what it makes for is an amazing true crime that happened, and an amazing kind of conspiracy theory in a way. And I think if you look at the guy, he's kind of become a bit of kind of like a Robin Hood. He's stealing from the rich to give to the poor, even though he's not. He's clearly keeping for himself, right? Or maybe he didn't, but nothing has been found. And so the fact that nothing has been found says to me that there's still something out there that we don't know.
Absolutely. I'm sorry, I'm looking at the, there's actually, I'm reminded of an actor named D.B. Sweeney. Do you remember him? He was back in the 80s. But, because obviously there, this whole thing that happened in 1971 with D.B. Cooper kind of inspired us, the rest of that video will show, and we'll put a link in the show notes for the folks to watch the full video if they wanted. Kind of goes into how that particular, heist or hijacking influenced some scenes in Hollywood movies that portrayed it. Actually, there was, I think, a remake or a retelling of his story as well back in old Hollywood movie. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Tom Cruise in the beginning, because I think it kind of did kind of like romanticize a little bit, kind of like that whole scenario of jumping out of a plane with money and, kind of getting away with it. Certainly had that appeal. But I mentioned D.B. Sweeney because I wonder if, once D.B. Sweeney was old enough to become an actor and wanted to get a stage name, he probably thought, oh, D.B. Cooper, that sounds cool. Maybe I'll be D.B. Sweeney,
I got to give him credit for that. I mean, it got him the very few roles that he got. what he should have done is been Dabney Coleman, even though that's nothing to do with it. But what are you going to do?
What are you going to do? Any final thoughts on D.B. Cooper?
I mean, I think unless they find something amazing to really suggest that he died throughout the thing, and I don't think that we've seen any evidence to that extent, but I think it's a really cool kind of, again, a victimless crime. Like, he didn't hurt anybody. He wasn't an asshole throughout the entire thing.
He
was really cool. It was almost like James Bond did this, for funsies. And he could have sort of went in there and did it. And, nobody can prove otherwise. And so I would say that it's one of the most cool crimes that has ever occurred. And we're lucky that it happened in the Pacific Northwest for whatever reason. I don't know if the guy was even from, I mean, clearly not. It wasn't the guy from the Dolls that did anything, but just the fact that we're associated with it, it kind of gives us a little bit of cred.
Just one more quick other conspiracy. What if that D.B. Cooper is indeed an accomplice? And again, just kind of like when the math wasn't mathing, the police was like, this can't be the guy. So let's rule him out. And then a week later he meets up with, I don't know, Gus or whatever the other guy's actual name is. And and then they got on their horses and rode off in the sunset or something. But be interesting.
I mean, if there was a bit of like Brokeback Mountain going on there, that's totally fine with me, and I have no issue with it. Or not, and they're just totally platonic. If they planned it together, again, they got away with it.
They did.
Again, they didn't spend that much money. It's not like they went and lived the rest of their lives and complete harmony. They just did it to do it. And if that's what they did, I'm down with it.
All right. Well, speaking of conspiracy theories, next week we will talk about the 10 little known conspiracy theories that will blow your mind.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, looking at this article, I'm sorry, the YouTube video is to me, I didn't know about some of this stuff, hence the little known piece of it. But I found it extremely entertaining and really amazing and kind of like, oh, my God, kind of thing. So I'm really looking forward to get into that because y'all are going to feel the same after you see the video and our reactions.
Well, until then, if you enjoy this content, please consider giving it a like and sharing it across your socials just to get
mash
the word
it,
out.
Mash it.
Yeah. Get the word out there regarding our channel and to help grow this channel. And if you haven't already done so, please do subscribe and hit that little notification bell so that you don't miss any new videos that we put out. Thank you so much for watching and we'll see you next time.